Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have four matters on our oral argument calendar today, and this is the second matter. So I'll ask the marshal to call the case.
Now calling A21-0519 in re the matter of the welfare of the children of BHK and AJSB parents.
And I have just a couple of quick reminders before we go ahead with arguments. You probably would both remember this anyway, but of course we're handling this matter, hearing the argument by video conference today. But all our other rules remain the same with regard to arguments in front of the Court of Appeals. So first of all, please identify yourself before you start your argument, as well as the client you represent. And then secondly, please keep your eye on the clock. The 15 minutes tends to go quickly, and we look forward to the conversation. So with that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Winkler, you can go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Winkler. I am attorney for appellant Adam Selbrad Bryan, the father in this TPR matter. I would begin by just briefly running over some of the historical facts regarding the children in this matter. The parents, Mr. Bryan and the mother, were not married. The county became particularly involved in these parents and this family's well-being upon a welfare check that was conducted with mother. Father was in treatment at the time. And following placement, father was in and out of treatment. There was a noted period where he was fleeing from the law. He then successfully completed inpatient treatment, was moved to a halfway house, which then closed 2 weeks later. He was then essentially out on his own recognizance, although there was a case plan in place at that point and questions surrounding his completion of that case plan are primary today. So the issues that I would like to bring before the court today are threefold. First, whether Brown County made reasonable efforts in reuniting this family. Did the trial court unreasonably discount father's progress he made in his treatment plan? And then finally, that Mr. Bryan had ineffective assistance of counsel. So as I indicated, after the children were placed with the county, Mr. Bryan absconded from a treatment program he was in, having learned about the status of the children. He was on the run for approximately 5 weeks until he was arrested on July 7th. He was jailed then, but it was still another 7 weeks before the county met with Mr. Bryan and a case plan was developed for him. Timelines, as we argue, are a major issue in this case because they were compressed. First, I would acknowledge through Mr. Bryan's own behavior, but secondly, because he was in jail for approximately 2 months before a case plan was developed for him. And then the petition to terminate the children's rights occurred only 4 months after a case plan was formulated for him. While he was on that case plan, Mr. Bryan did make progress. As I'd indicated, he completed inpatient treatment an inpatient treatment program at East Haven. And while the court finds that his prognosis at that point was guarded, Lori Gildersleeve, his psychologist at Meridian Behavioral Health, testified that father's prognosis was pretty good. And Emily Lemke, father's alcohol and drug counselor at New Beginnings, testified that father had made progress and she did not have any concerns about father moving forward. So the most direct forms of information regarding Mr. Bryant's progress regarding his treatment or his prognosis following inpatient treatment were the ones who testified that his prognosis was actually pretty good.
Oh, Mr. Winkler, if I may.
Yes. You know,
and I understand your argument as far as his progress in making the progress in treatment, but looking at the legal issue about whether it was error to find that the county made reasonable efforts to reunite father and children, you know, focusing on, which I think was you're leading with, I just struggle with how one can say that there weren't reasonable efforts where the county offered the services to allow the father to visit the children and the father didn't follow through and take the steps necessary to visit with the children. I mean, isn't that really even saying, okay, he was making progress in treatment, but isn't that the fundamental thing the county should be doing? And they did it.
I would say that the testimony regarding that issue is conflicted, and perhaps when I get to my final argument regarding assistance of counsel, not properly developed by his attorney, as Mr. Bryant's testimony regarding these issues was far different from what the county's testimony was regarding his desire to see the children, the efforts he made to participate in therapy. And I would note for the court that all of this is happening in the backdrop of a COVID pandemic in which everything has to be done by video. Mr. Bryan had a substantial period of time where there was concerns regarding his positive diagnosis. That certainly affected his ability to participate as well.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. I have a question for you. Again, sure. Focusing on your contention that the district court erred in finding that the county made reasonable reunification efforts. I would like you to answer two specific questions for me. First, how did the delay in developing the initial case plan once your client was back in custody prejudice him, noting that the county argues that at that point in time, everything they ended up asking him to do, he was already required to do as part of probation or a large part of it? And what other services should the county have offered to make them reasonable, in your opinion?
Your Honor, I would answer the first question regarding the timelines and the delay by noting the overall period that Mr. Bryan had a case plan in place prior to the time that the petition for termination occurred, and understanding that he was in treatment, completed treatment, was asked to go to a halfway house, did that, and through no fault of his own, 2 weeks later, that program is canceled. And then there seems to be, the testimony that was provided in court was that the situation was chaotic as they had to place 15
counsel,
to 20
but
persons.
I'm struggling to understand, and I appreciate those are the facts, but how would any of that have been different if the county social worker had met with your client 1 week after he was incarcerated and developed the written case plan then?
Well, again, and looking through the testimony and the conflicts that exist within it. Again, this is reliant on Mr. Bryan's own testimony, as few other witnesses recalled, regarding the efforts that he was making. He was trying to go to therapy with the children, and issues as to whether what the lines of communication were between county caseworkers and him as far as getting the actual establishment of these services in place. I understand that the record is clear that the county was offering services A, B, and C, but from a practical standpoint, what was the actual lines of communication? What was occurring between caseworkers, probation officers, et cetera, when after the outpatient program was closed or the halfway house was closed, there does not seem to be much in the record as far as what steps were being taken or what was occurring as far as how were we in contact with them, what were we trying to get them to do, et cetera, et cetera. Most of that comes through probation, not through his probation officer and not through the caseworker, guardian ad litem, et cetera. So I believe that's where the question lies regarding
your argument seems to be they didn't have a real good working relationship or good lines of communication, and that's the failure in terms of reasonable efforts.
I would say that given the circumstances, the additional time that would have been provided if there would have been 2 months on the front end where he had a case plan and time on the back end where he could have continued to complete that the work on his case plan, that many of those issues could have been resolved.
Okay. So you're essentially equating the provision of more time to work his case plan with the provision of reasonable efforts. I mean,
it seems like
all of the arguments come down to he should have had more time. And the fact that the court didn't give him more time means that there weren't reasonable efforts.
I would say that that's one way to yes, I would agree with that characterization, yes, of the argument.
Then let me ask this in terms of legal authority for that proposition. I mean, we all know that the timelines are very expedited for these types of cases. There's nothing that prevents the county from going straight to a TPR petition. What law do you cite that says condensed timeline that is not unlawful under the statutes or the rules equates with unreasonable efforts. It seems to me that that's a policy issue that's already resolved by the imposition of strict guidelines.
I don't think that line of reasoning is arguable. I think that's absolutely right. Getting to my next point or a later point, again, this appears to be the strategy that was selected by his counsel. His counsel asked very few questions of any of the county's witnesses, and they were all directed at the fact that, well, Mr. Bryan should have had more time in order to work his case plan. Whether there's a soundness in that strategy, given what you just pointed out regarding this being a policy issue rather than something that is specifically impinging on Mr. Bryan's rights. Again, that was the strategy his attorney picked for him, apparently based on the testimony and the questions that were asked. The fact that that argument may not in and of itself been the most sound, and then the execution of that strategy when it seems that counsel was not familiar with the statutory timelines involved in this matter, it leads exactly to that latter point. I don't think there was some question as to the intention of Mr. Bryan's counsel in his line of questioning, but I think it's straightforward. He specifically asked the child protective caseworker, Lori Nelson, if the law requires that the termination be definitely made at 12 months. And she responded that that was correct. And that seems to have created a benchmark in everybody's mind as to the notion that at 1 year from the date of placement, this had to be finalized. And therefore, Mr. Bryan had X amount of time, which would have been 2 months, which is just simply not correct.
Also, at the time, did he ever start outpatient treatment after his halfway house closed?
I don't believe that that's indicated.
How long
in the
did
record.
He have to do that to get started?
His outpatient program would have closed in approximately, I don't have that date in front of me here, but he would have had approximately 3 months, would be my estimation regarding that.
The halfway house closes. They want him to go to a new halfway house. He says, no, I'm going to go to outpatient treatment. 3 months later, we have a TPR trial. And in that 3 months, he's not started outpatient treatment. How would a district court conclude under those circumstances, or how would we conclude that, well, if he had another 2 months, it was likely that he would have done or started outpatient treatment? What reason did he give anyone to think he was going to start cooperating with the services?
Well, if the record was that clear and concise, it would be hard to disagree with that position. But again, what he was advised upon the closure of the halfway house was that he should return home or return to his brother's home, basically on his own recognizance, and attend outpatient treatment. That was the professional recommendation of East Haven upon its closure. Again, that was revised through criminal proceedings, a Rule 25 that asked that he go to an outpatient program as well. But again, separate from the CHIPS matter, and what eventually became the TPR matter. And again, I mean, the larger issue here is regarding, what is the effectiveness of counsel if there's a really fundamental issue regarding the understanding of timelines as they're involved in this matter. And again,
counsel, that's why I'm sort of trying to drill down on how would things have been different? Because if we're going to look at ineffective assistance of counsel, and if we're going to use the standard from Strickland, criminal standard in the civil case, which we have done in the past, the first prong concerns the adequacy of counsel's representation. The second prong is the prejudice prong, and the case law is clear. If the argument fails on either prong and it's appellant's burden to show the argument successful, he loses. And I'm just having a hard time with the second prong in Strickland. In other words, if counsel had properly argued, oh, he's entitled to 4 more months instead of he's entitled to 2 more months, do we really think it would have made a difference given his track record to that point, given that he had 3 months between the closure of the halfway house and the start of trial, in which people kind of agreed with his assertion that he just needed to go to outpatient treatment? You know, why do we think it would have been different? Why do we think the district court would have said, oh, he's got 4 months, not two, I'm going to give him another 4 months to start treatment that he hadn't started in the past 3 months?
I suppose this will provide a reasonable closure of my arguments in total here. Is 4 months would have essentially doubled the amount of time that he was on a case plan from the time the case plan was formed to the termination being filed in its petition. I mean, so we're not talking about a matter of, you know, 10% more time, 15% more time, understanding that his completion of the case plan is problematic, but at the same time, he did complete aspects of it, and with additional opportunity to work further, that is the basis of the argument.
Ms. Larkin, anything further?
No, thank you.
All right. So Mr. Winkler, of course, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll continue to hear from you at that point if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So we're resetting the clock and we have it. Ms. Jensen, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jill Jensen and I represent the respondent, Brown County Human Services. As counsel indicated, we're here on an appeal from a termination of parental rights, and the appellant is contesting the findings and conclusions regarding the children's best interests, as well as reasonable efforts to rehabilitate the appellant. When there's no motion for a new trial made, the review is strictly limited to whether the findings are supported by substantial evidence and whether those findings support its conclusions of law, as this court knows. First and foremost, I would point out that the court made the findings required under Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 39.05 regarding the child's interest in the relationship, the appellant's interest in the relationship, and the children's competing interests. In making those findings, all of them are supported by the record. The court found that the child's interest was minimal in the parent-child relationship due to anxiety and stress about permanency, particularly with the eldest child who is in therapy. She had voiced concerns about who would take care of her and a lot of uncertainty about permanency in this case. The court also noted that her therapist noted that appellant's participation in therapy was somewhat destructive in that he made promises to the child, which universally accepted as something a parent should not do until it's something cleared, because we don't want to make promises to a child that we can't keep. The court then considered the appellant's interest in the relationship. The court found that he had demonstrated a lack of interest in the parent-child relationship through his conduct rather than his verbal interest in the relationship, and nothing more particularly demonstrates this, I think, than his argument that the child should have a different therapist because he did not agree that his child had stated some things to the therapist that he did not believe were true. It was not motivated at all by the best interest of the child, which is particularly evident of his lack of interest in the child's best interest or placing his own interest above the children. The court also considered the second child's interest and concluded that he was too young to voice an interest in the parent-child relationship. And then the court considered the children's competing interests in a safe, stable, permanent home, which was supported by substantial evidence, at the very least the testimony of the guardian ad litem and the child protection social worker, as well as the guardian ad litem's report going through the best interest factors. The district court then found that the county had made reasonable efforts to rehabilitate the appellant and provide him or reunite him with the children. My understanding is that the appellant in this case is only contesting the timeliness of services offered. In this case, the appellant had 10 months from the time the children were placed out of home to complete services. The timeline in this case shows that the delay in starting or creating a case plan was almost entirely due to appellant himself. He was in treatment when this case came in. He, 4 days later, prior to having a chance to develop a case plan, he absconded. He was on the run for over a month, during which time the social worker was actually in contact with him and noted that they needed to make a case plan when he was ready to come in and meet with her. And he refused to disclose his location. And in doing so, he had voiced an interest in treatment, but ultimately decided, no, I have warrants out for my arrest. I'm not going to disclose my location. In July, he's ultimately picked up again on new drug charges. He had overdosed during that time. He was initially in the Renville County Jail and then was transferred to the Brown County Jail to deal with probation violations, at which time the social worker went to the jail. She met with him. She developed a case plan. That case plan focused on chemical dependency, mental health, two of appellant's biggest issues. The appellant was furloughed from jail to attend treatment. He was discharged to a halfway house reluctantly. As he notes, that halfway house closed due to no fault of his own. However, after his discharge, which was on October 23rd, the appellant did absolutely nothing. He did nothing through November, through December, and then ultimately was arrested in January on new charges. At the time of trial, he had been detained since then on probation violations and new charges. He admitted that there was stolen property in excess of $1,000 in his home. He was found with the mother, who is not present in these proceedings, as she was not throughout the case. There was methamphetamine or a scale with methamphetamine residue located on it, for which mother was charged. But you can see through their jail text that she assigned the possession of that scale to appellant. There was also alcohol located. These facts support the district court findings that the majority of this delay was made of appellant's own volition. He points repeatedly to the fact that he only had a case plan for 4 months, but it wasn't 4 months that the children were out of the home. The children had been out of the home for many more months. Their timelines don't pause just because he decided to go on the run and do drugs and not check in.
Ms. Jensen?
Yes.
If I could ask, I think, a related question. I just want to make sure I understand the facts right. Between the time that the county filed the CHIPS petition and the time of trial, which was, you know, less than a year, right?
Yep.
What, 8, 9 months, somewhere around there? How many times had the appellant here seen the children, including video? I want to include any video visits. I don't talk about opportunities. I just want to,
Absolutely.
Can you just clarify that for me?
Yes. He did not see child two at all. He saw child one twice via therapy during that time. I know you asked not to ask about opportunities, but I would note that he was given a referral to Keep Me Safe Visitation Center. He failed to appear for that orientation, which was why he didn't have any visits with child two. But during the 10 months this case was open, the social worker, it's actually evident throughout court exhibit number one, which shows all the efforts the social worker made in the case, that she sent appellant specifically therapy resources. Judge, you're muted, but I think you're trying to ask me a question.
I am. Thank you. And I was hitting the wrong icon, as always. I just want to make sure I understand the timeline. So it sounds like between the time of the CHIPS petition and the start of the TPR trial, 10 months elapsed. Is that correct?
Yes, that is accurate.
And then I've got the visits. Now, how long was the case plan active? In other words, how much time between his signing the case plan, agreeing to the services, and the trial starting?
If you don't mind me counting on my fingers, as I'm not a mathematician. Let's see. So October 27th, he signed the plan. August, September. More than 6 months had passed.
Six months.
I apologize for that.
That's okay. And so his argument then is, okay, at that point, everybody was thinking he only had another 2 months. He really had another 4 months. Do you want to address the prejudice prong? Because, I mean, I'm not seeing that under the law, he was entitled to another 2 months. I mean, there are ways a person can ask for more time. Was that request made? In other words, did he make any sort of evidentiary showing that he was in compliance and therefore the permanency deadline should be extended?
Absolutely. That actually was addressed. Approximately 6 months into the case, the district court actually extended up to an additional 6 months for appellant to work a case plan based upon his progress in inpatient treatment. After appellant had done absolutely nothing for approximately 2 months and had been finally located and arrested, the district court gave permission for Brown County Human Services to file a permanency or a termination of parental rights petition.
And let me stop you again. So at what point did the district court make the finding that an extension of the permanency deadline would be appropriate?
Sure. I think I put that in my facts, so let me try and find it.
Okay. But that was when he was in treatment working on his case.
I think it was either when he was in treatment or had recently been discharged to the halfway house.
Okay, but at a point where he was cooperating. So it just seems to me like what's supposed to happen happened. When he was participating and working his case plan, the district court said, we're going to extend the permanency deadlines to give him an opportunity to demonstrate ability to parent. And then when he stopped doing that, the district court said, we're moving to permanency.
Yes, I think that would be an accurate way of how this case was handled. We did proceed with the termination of parental rights at 6 months as to mother, but they did extend the timelines an additional 6 months for appellant. And so I'm going to try and touch on math again, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but the argument has been here that, well, the council should have made an argument for 4 months instead of 2 extra months. My understanding, and I'm not in his counsel's head, so I don't know, but how I interpreted the argument was that the district court initially extended up to an additional 6 months, and 12 months would be the total extended timeline that a parent is typically given to work reunification prior to filing the permanency decision. So if we're at trial at 10 months, he should be given an additional 2 months prior to a decision being made on permanency. Regardless of whether or not that was ineffective, I think it's pretty clear that that was an effective strategy or a sound strategy, because that's what appellant's argument is up here on appeal, is that he should have been given more time. And that was his argument in the district court. Nonetheless, the district court, it's very clear that there's not a reasonable probability that there would have been a different result in this case. The district court made multiple findings touching on that. The district court credited the testimony of a social worker that he could not parent in the reasonably foreseeable future. The child's therapist testified that it is not realistic for him to reunite with at least child one in the future, given her fear and the fact that it had not yet been addressed. The court noted that appellant specifically admitted that he knew he had to provide drug tests between October 23rd and his arrest on January 7th, but admitted he did not do so. And of particular note, he was aware that he had to submit that test in order to resume visitation with child one in therapy. So the fact that he didn't do it, despite acknowledging that he knew he had to do it, shows or demonstrates that this would not be there is not a reasonable probability of a different result. The court found in finding note 81 that there's no explanation of appellant as to how he can address these conditions when he has not done so in the last 10 months. And of particular note is that appellant's plan that he articulated when he testified at trial of what he needed to accomplish to address those conditions was the exact same plan that he said he had to do on October 23rd when he was discharged from the halfway house. and did absolutely nothing for 3 months. So the district court extrapolated from his past performance and noted and found that, well, he didn't do anything for 3 months with this plan. Now he has the same plan. There's not a reasonable probability that he's going to follow through with it. The district court noted that he had not complied with aftercare results. He didn't even attend the treatment he claimed appropriate. And of particular note, in support of the district court's finding that appellant had been manipulative in his discharge recommendations from inpatient treatment and halfway house, in the text messages between appellant and the mother in this case, he tells the mother to get a second chemical dependency assessment because her first one recommended inpatient. And if she got a second one, she could then have outpatient. The district court also found that specifically on page 20 in finding 8A, that the children could not be returned to his care in the reasonably foreseeable future. Again, there's no mention of this 2 month deadline that appellant appears to be hinging his argument on. The court notes that he has not received any chemical dependency treatment, no mental health treatment, no demonstration of sobriety. And that's despite the referrals that the social worker made to engage him. So for all those reasons, the county or the respondent is requesting that you affirm the district court's decision. And I'm out of time. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jensen. So we'll reset the clock, Mr. Winkler. And appellant has 5 minutes for a rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be brief. Regarding a point that Ms. Jensen just made regarding mental health, I believe the record indicated that Mr. Bryan did take some efforts regarding his mental health. It just was not specific to anger management, as was the recommendation. I believe that was a finding in the record. There was not an issue or a question raised as to whether father loved the children. And the testimony, I think, as provided by the guardian ad litem, when specifically asked, was that yes, in fact, that the father does love the children. This wasn't a case of parental abandonment. Specifically, of the six questions that counsel for Mr. Bryan asked the guardian ad litem, one was if father could be a good parent to the children, to which she said yes. The follow-up on redirect was, again, focused on 2 months. If we're looking at this in 2 months, is father able to adequately parent the children? To which the answer is no. And again, that gets to the arbitrariness of, or the incorrectness of the of attorney for father's counsel regarding his opinion regarding the nature of the statutes and what the timelines are in this matter. And I think that puts this issue in a nutshell. And if there are no further questions, that's my only addition to the record at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler. Is there anything else from the panel? Okay. All right. Thanks again to both lawyers in this case for your briefs and for your arguments. It very much helps the court, and this matter is now submitted for this court's decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe, which is expedited for this case. So with that, we've concluded our second oral argument this morning, and counsel should feel free to exit if you so choose. Obviously, this remains a public hearing. We have two more matters that are on our calendar. The next one is scheduled to begin at 11 a.m. So thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.